Hello and welcome to another episode of A Critical Ear, broadcasting on Flirt FM 101.3 on acriticalear.info and elsewhere on the World Wide Web. This month we're talking about policing in America. We recorded much of our episode shortly after the decision in the Derek Chauvin trial for the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And so this gives us an opportunity to reflect in a little more detail than I think we often do in Irish broadcasting on some of the issues around policing and race in America. We're honoured to have as our guest this month Netva Freeman. Freeman works with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He's an organiser with Pan-African Community Action on the Coordinating Committee of the Black Alliance for Peace, and is the co-producer and host for the radio show and podcast Voices with Vision on WPFW 89.3. His writings have been published in Black Star News, Black Agenda Report, Pamazuka News, Common Dreams, Global Research, and elsewhere. And we get an opportunity over the next while to learn a little bit about attitudes towards policing, some of the militarization and other crises involving policing in the US. And so I hope that you'll find it an interesting and provocative discussion. Stay tuned.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A fresh UN-led bid to seek to resolve decades of tensions in Cyprus began in Geneva on Tuesday, with Secretary-General Antonio Guterres realistic about making progress, his spokesperson said. The informal talks come 4 years since the leaders of the Greek, Cypriot and Turkish communities met, also in Switzerland, without managing to reach an agreement on the divided island's future. Stefan Dujarric, spokesperson for the Secretary-General, said that the purpose of the three-day meeting was to determine whether common ground exists for a negotiated solution to the Cyprus issue in the foreseeable future.
The Secretary-General will move forward based on the outcomes of the informal talks. As we've said, and I think I said back in February and other times in briefings in New York, the parties are welcome to be creative, and the Secretary-General will be encouraging them to move, you know, to use diplomatic language in a sincere and frank manner. Again, it's important to stress that these are informal talks.
The COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted the workplace dangers faced by key workers who need far greater protection to do their jobs safely, the International Labour Organization said on Tuesday. A new report by the ILO found that 7,000 health workers have died since the outbreak of the crisis, whilst 136 million health and social care workers are at risk of contracting COVID-19 as a professional hazard. Mental health pressures associated with the pandemic should also be taken into account by governments planning for the next pandemic, the UN agency said, as one in five healthcare workers globally has reported depression and anxiety symptoms. Teleworking has also blurred the lines between work and private life, adding to people's mental stress, the ILO said, with 65% of businesses reporting that worker morale had been difficult to sustain while at home. The leader of Myanmar's military must commit to honouring the fundamental right to people's freedom of expression without fear of violent reprisals, a UN-appointed independent rights expert said on Tuesday. In an open letter to Senior General Ming Un Lang, Special Rapporteur Tom Andrews insisted that this was literally a matter of life or death. To date, the targeted attacks against demonstrators have claimed 750 lives, including young children, Mr. Andrews said, after reminding the head of the military junta that he'd reportedly agreed to an immediate ceasefire in Myanmar at the meeting of regional leaders at the weekend. Since the military takeover and arrest of the country's elected officials, there have been near daily peaceful protests across the country calling for the restoration of democracy. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Thank you.
You wouldn't buy a car without knowing its history. So why would you buy a story without knowing who's telling it? Come here and I'll tell you. It's not always easy to verify what you see, read, or hear. But now, there's help. Visit www.bmediasmart.ie. Stop. Think. Check. Be Media Smart. Brought to you by Media Literacy Ireland, supported by your local radio station.
Moving on, and before we move to our interview with Netfa Freeman, we're going to hear some audio recorded recently at the Thompson Center in Chicago, Illinois, recorded by Dale Lehman of WZRD and syndicated through the AINFO's radio project. This is Sidney Wallace of the Jewish Council on Urban Affairs speaking at a rally calling for the passage of an ordinance known as the Empowering Communities for Public Safety Ordinance. It's responding to various instances of police killings and police misconduct in Illinois and elsewhere. The rally took place as City Council was meeting for the first time in person following the pandemic in Chicago, and also the day following the Derek Chauvin guilty verdict in his trial for the killing of George Floyd.
Yesterday, as a nation, we waited in anticipation for a verdict that should have been a no-brainer, because none of us knew if the system would fail us again. As we waited, that system took another life of a young girl in Ohio. As that trial was going, we lost a young man mere miles from where that trial was held. And here in our city, we lost one of our children. I have four children myself. And every day, along with every other parent, I am sure, I hold my children a little tighter and a little longer, praying that I can protect them from a world that does not see the beauty and humanity in their lives. When it becomes too much for me, I am comforted inside of my husband's strong embrace, but I know those same muscles that protect me could be what makes him most vulnerable if an officer decides that he fits a profile or that he looks menacing. We should not live in fear of our families being torn apart by police violence. We should not have to continue to add to the list of things that we, as working class people, as black and brown people, as people with mental health issues, have to do in the face of those we are told are trained professionals in order to survive. We have a right to determine the rules in which we all live, and passing the people's ordinance will ensure our collective voice is not only heard, but amplified. In deciding policy, in hiring and firing the COPA head, in deciding how we want our children to live and work and thrive in our communities, we shouldn't have to go through this every time. I shouldn't wake up every morning to another child gone. Whatever their age, it is someone's child. How long before it's my child or your child, your husband, your wife? We need to pass the people's ordinance now. The name says it all: Empowering Communities for Public Safety. Thank you.
The voice you heard there was Sidney Wallace with the Jewish Council on Urban Affairs. She was speaking at a rally in Chicago, Illinois on Wednesday, the 21st of April, the day following the guilty verdict for Derek Chauvin in the killing of George Floyd. The event was a rally calling for the passage of an ordinance termed the Empowering Communities for Public Safety Ordinance, looking for community control of the police in Chicago, Illinois. And that, I think, gives us a good segue into our conversation with Netfa Freeman, who talks about that concept of community control as it arises in the US and about some of the history of the conflict involving police there.
I'm speaking with Neffa Freeman this month. Neffa's with the Institute for Policy Studies, the Black Alliance for Peace, and Pan-African Community Action. And we're talking today in the aftermath of the verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial, which drew attention to issues of police abuses in the US, and also some of the responses, community responses seeking to enact structural change and structural fixes for some of the issues we've seen. Ms. Freeman, if we can start, one of the things that I want to start with is a trend that we've seen in the US police over the last decade or more that has got, or I suppose 20 years now, that's got some attention, has been militarization of the US police. Now, that's something in the Irish context, our police, some are armed, but not all are. But militarization of the police in the US is on a whole different scale, I think, to what many of our listeners will be used to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it does have a history. It goes a little bit far back than that, but the current militarization of the police is a provision that was put in the what's known as the National Defense Authorization Act. It was started in, I think it was the 90s, if I'm not correct, and under Bill Clinton, the presidency of Bill Clinton. And then in that act, there was introduced a provision in it known as the 1033 program. That authorizes, I'm sorry, hold on.
You're all good.
That authorizes the Department of Defense or to transfer military equipment, all kinds of military equipment, to local police forces and their departments. And they can apply for it, and some they get grants, and some they might have to pay some a little bit. And so that started then, but we can actually trace the first militarization of police, and then we have to understand, this helps understand the purpose of it, to the 60s and the early 70s with what people commonly know as SWAT. So that's militarized police, you know, special weapons and tactics. And those were created to confront the Black Panther Party and what they would consider militarized. So it has nothing to do with trying to fight crime or anything. It has to do with what they consider a threat to the status quo of the United States, and intensified under the National Defense, the 1033 program. So since then, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of military equipment has been transferred to local police forces. And then we actually got more attention in the rise because of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And you actually got to see them deployed. And so they were deployed against people protesting, you know, against the indignation of being killed by police. And you have to understand, in the US, this police, the killing of us by Black and brown people, working class people, by London, and really it's just Black and brown because they don't know your class when they're killing you, right? But in general, that's the target, is that has gone on for centuries here. You know, it's just the police. And so anyway, just to answer your question, the emergence and the intensification of it, because we're seeing an increase of this transfer, is because of the unrest that they are, you know, and you see all, mostly under George Floyd, which was sort of like a crescendo of unrest because of police abuses. And so they're you know, that's what that's about. It's keeping, containing, and controlling versus redress. You know, we have to understand there's an easy way to do it, just give people redress, but they're not really trying to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think just on that issue of militarization, you mentioned the 1033 program. I lived in the States for a little while. This, you know, it's armored vehicles. You're seeing ex combat vehicles. You're seeing weapons. This isn't just, you know, a piece, you know, small bits or pieces here or there, army surplus. This is large, mm-hmm. large scale in terms of what they're doing.
Right.
You mentioned the George Floyd case, and of course that's not the only one that people even here in Ireland have heard in the last year. There's my understanding is there's thousands of deaths at the hands of police.
Yes.
Every year. What's the sort of scale we're looking at in terms of, and I suppose not just deaths, you've highlighted in your own work kind of the broader landscape of abuses and suppression that we're looking at.
Before getting to the direct answer to your question, I think it's important for people to understand like the historical context that the United States is a settler colony. It was a settled colony and it was done at the expense of indigenous people, Native Americans who are forced to live on reservations and relegated to a second class of citizenship. And then the enslaved Africans were brought from the continent of Africa. And so as working class, while we say the black and brown working class people are the most directly impacted by the system of the United States, the persistent white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy, which is the three-headed, what I refer to as the three-headed hydra of settler colonialism in the U.S., probably settler colonialism anywhere, really, is what that means, because everywhere there is, that's what characterizes it in history. And that as a result, while there may be some nominal, advancements that people might say, generally that characteristic is persist in that the police that in the United States, the most modern form of police, their antecedents are the slave patrols that run around and caught, escaped slaves, put down insurrections, that kind of thing. And then also in the North, more like 100 years later or so, the other aspect of it were the private security agencies that were supporting the capitalists and were putting down strikes and protecting warehouses and protecting capitalists, and they were private. And then those components evolved into what we know as the police now. And as a result of having these, inherently racist, inherently classist, and inherently misogynist, sexist underpinnings, regardless of whether the color of a police officer, often here they keep it reduced to that, we see excessive abuses by these forces, these elements, because they know they can get away with, the stay and that has to protect them. They have to give impunity to some level because they need, the rulers need that force. And so there was a study done by known the Malcolm X grassroots movement, and this was right after your listeners may have heard of the Trayvon Martin case, where the vigilante George Zimmerman killed him, and I'm trying to blank on the exact year. I think it was 2012 or something, like I can't remember exactly, but that study that they did, a very professional study that hasn't gotten any attention, showed that every 28 hours, in fact they had 48 first, but then they updated it because more information came, someone, a black person in this country, is killed by a security guard, a vigilante, or a police officer every 20 hours. Since then, they've very recently, because they've never really done this statistic, have updated it to actually it's almost like 3 per day. And so we're seeing the high profile ones, because something happens, it's a kind of strange chemistry of mix of when something, George Floyd, obviously that it was caught on camera and the egregiousness of it, the heinous, person standing on the person's neck and everyone saying stop, and that kind of, makes things viral. Eric Garner, these kind of things become more viral for whatever, however reason, but some people don't realize the frequency of this because some of them, just most of them, we just don't know the people's names. And this is characteristic component of what it takes to keep the ruling class, the status quo in place, compounded by neoliberal, or the economic order of neoliberalism, where the state actually is very involved in setting policies to maintain capitalist exploitation, a hyper exploitation, austerity, and under pandemic it's been very revealed. I don't want to go on too much about that, but those all cause for the unrest instead of us getting what people deserve, human beings, human rights, we get repression. And so,
so there is that sense then that as you say, we see and coming internationally, some of the high profile cases you mentioned, Trayvon Martin, you've got George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and so on.
Sandra Bland, they're gone, we have to give credit to the movement, and it's when, and this is what people, the United States and the right, we're seeing in the media now, there's, and part of containing the unrest is a manipulation of the narrative. It's to make us, you know, think, well, oh, the, you know, and manipulation of the narrative to one to for us to believe that our, that justice or, you know, some kind of redress can be left in the hands of the rulers, the status quo, the government, and the policymakers and whatnot, and that the there's nothing that comes of civil unrest, you know, what they would say is the bad protesters versus the good protesters, the ones who, you know, commit violent acts as quote unquote, you know. And the historical examination shows that it's exactly the opposite. Though both those things are the opposite, that we can't rely on the rulers because their job is to, I mean, the policymakers, because their job is to maintain the rulers' place. And that anytime progress, you know, a lot of significant progress has been gained in the United States, it's because of some serious civil unrest, the Haymarket, you know, with the 5-day work week and everything, the you know, the civil unrest in the civil rights era, you know, that came, you know, the civil rights bill and all that. They did a Kerner Commission report at trying to study what's wrong with people, the Stonewall rebellion for people who were getting LGBTQ rights. These are, and we could see the only reason they even attempted to prosecute Derek Chauvin, who killed George Floyd, is because of the unrest in the streets that they realized that they have to, you know, and that's the, so, you know, I'm not suggesting, I'm not trying to advocate that, but this is a historical examination.
Mm-hmm. That was striking in the aftermath of the verdict this week. I think in the run up to it, people juxtaposing the initial statements from the Minneapolis Police Department. Somebody died, nothing to see here. That really was after the witness videotape came out, after pressure and protest, that was only then that you got the prosecution. It was only then that the police chief, you know, gave testimony against Chauvin.
Right. And then this is also interesting because we have to think about, because of the persistence of the problem, then what is the problem? If our analysis is correct, that we're a colonized people, because we're a colonized people in the United States, and the issue is decolonization, then a trial for one cop that they clearly decided to throw under the bus to maintain the system and to alleviate the pressure from people is not what our goal should be. And a lot of people will tell you, even you hear anybody, even though they might be relieved that he gets what he deserves, they're saying, well, that's not, you know, we can't stop here. Anybody will tell you that, you know, we can't stop here. So, but what the powers that be are trying to do is confuse the masses and make us think, well, it's about trials and prosecutions and quote unquote accountability, when it really should be about self-determination. It should be about democratic community control. It should be about power. It has to be about a power shift to those who are most impacted, because that's the issue here, is that the police and that those, the powers that be, do what they do. And we I don't know if we can even talk about the foreign policy and how that's connected, because it's very connected. They do what they do because they have the power to do it, you know. And so the only way for us to really get any redress, we have to have, we have to talk about how do people, you know, if there are officers or agents enabled to patrol our communities and carry guns and kill us and do this, how are they not under the control of those communities if this is a really free and democratic society? They should be under the, not under the control of the capitalists or the policymakers, the political, you know, class. They should be under the control of the people.
And this is where I think you have a particular analysis and a particular argument for community control that I suppose I was going to, perhaps not differs, but finesses some of the rhetoric we're seeing around the protest. One of the calls has been to defund the police, and there's been arguments about whether or not defunding is, you know, to just scale down, or is it a step towards abolition? And you make the argument for community control. What's, I suppose, on the one hand, we know that the U.S. police is heavily funded, so you know that's one of the reasons why we talked about the military surplus and so on. One of the reasons why you see those calls for defunding, for I suppose de-escalation of the of how much resources are centered in there. But you've made the case that simple defunding won't work for the sorts of goals that you've identified.
Well, I think that what we're trying to say is that the calls for defunding, defunding as a demand that's actually rests the implementation or the actualization of it in the hands of the same people who are the problem. That's what's not going to work. I mean, clearly the police departments are overfunded and resources should be used otherwise in very neglected and disenfranchised communities and peoples and classes. But we have to right now that in the U.S. there's a lot of, you know, the powers that be will have us engaging in campaigns that think that it's about reform. That we, you know, the policymakers will implement the right things, and then we just, you know, do direct action and yell at them enough, and then that's going to happen. But what we're saying is this is a question of power, that the people, it's not just about mobilization, it's about organization, that people must organize in our communities at the same time that we do mobilizations, that we challenge the status quo, the state, and the, you know, the order. At the same time we do that, we organize ourselves to take democratic and collective democratic control over the institutions that govern our lives. And as we do that, we can use, in the United States, they put a lot in terms of, they reduce democracy to voting for representatives who are gonna do right. And then, but even though it's heavily skewed because big money determines who really gets, you know, elected and all that, and that they don't really wanna talk about the fundamental issues of capitalism or anything like those people, if they're not beholden to capitalism and the foreign policies and all that, then you won't get elected. They won't fund you, right? But we're saying there's other mechanisms of power that we need to leverage. One, we have to organize in such a way that even different people have different ways of implementing community control, so that the issue is shifting the power into the hands of the finding ways, and we have ways of, different groups have different ways of doing it, into the hands of the people directly impacted who are organized to make democratic collective decisions about things, and they should have control, power meaning control, over the policies, the priorities, the duties, the hiring, the firing, the budget of what is given for police, you know. And if we can do that, then we can get out any, we can fire any racist cops, we can just reimagine it, we can redo everything. And that even includes, if it could include taking away, which is what an actual defunding would be mean, reducing the amount of funds that are applied to, you know, public safety officers or policing, and applying it to something else that should be under community control as well. Because we're not just talking about community control of the police, we're talking about community control in general, but police obviously is one critical move that needs to happen right away. And so we definitely, basically we're saying that we can't realize defunding, especially not defunding all the way to zero to about abolition, unless we have power. And for us to have power, we have to fight for community control of the police.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the, Kevin, in thinking about community control, one of the issues that comes to mind for me I forget the name of the neighborhood where Dante Wright was tragically killed just a week or two ago. Where I think the police there said none of the police officers on the police force in that city live inside the city bounds. And this isn't unusual, I know, but it goes to show, you know, it's tied to segregation. I watched the press conference there, the news conference. You had a black city manager, you had a black mayor, and you had a white police chief. And the police officers in that city all coming from outside that community. I'm sure that's only one small piece, but that strikes me as kind of part and parcel of this notion of community embedding and community control of the police.
And there's definitely relevant, you know, this makeup, it shows the contradiction there in terms of, you know, so obviously if the people had control over what public safety looks like, and some people have issues with the term policing, we're even getting pushed, a police community controlled police because they're for abolition. But we're saying, well, we're not against abolition. We're saying we have to have control. But obviously when there's, you know, there's a white police chief and then you have black mayors and all that, shows that also, it shows something else. It shows the reductionist methods that the system will use to reduce everything to race. But we have to include class. We have to include it in there. In Chicago, they have a mayor who's a black woman and queer black woman, right? A lesbian black woman. And she's just as bad on all the other kind of things, because there's the class issue is being ignored. So we know that can't. And that because the police chief, even though a lot of them are white in these places, the police chief being black won't, you know, address the issue. What addresses the issue is that the most impacted working class people have to have power and they have to be in control. Then they can choose whoever that person is and create the qualifications for, which of course, like you said, one of them would have to be, you got to live in a community. You can't be coming from somewhere else and be here. We might not even, you know, so it doesn't matter. And you have, and so they have to have that qualification, whatever qualifications they should have the power to create those and implement them.
Mm-hmm. On the issue of community control, you're involved, of course, with the Pan-African Community Action, which addresses this, but a broader, you know, approach, I suppose, to democracy. What is the example of community control of police? Is that emblematic of what you'd see in broader terms? Is there, you know, how would you characterize, you know, what your broader goals would be, I suppose?
So broader goals for Pan-African Community Action, we're Pan-Africanists, meaning that we believe that the total liberation of Africa under socialist government is what's going to, you know, system, is what's going to liberate all African people everywhere. But then as Pan-Africanists who live in the United States and in particular based in Washington, D.C., then that will come about by Africans everywhere organizing on the local level for community-based power that puts the power in the hands of the most directly impacted classes. And in this case, in our case, we would say that assert the working class, black women and LGBTQ people should be the leading, you know, leading the struggle. And so we're organizing for that with political education. And then, so we believe in socialism. We're avowed anti-capitalist and for socialists. And so for socialism, which means everyone has the right to, you know, all kind of things, healthcare and living conditions, all these kind of things. And that community control of the police is one campaign that we feel is designed to advance that struggle, because of what's taking place right now with the police and or the intention, not what's taking place, because it's been taking, what they do has been taking place for it, but the attention is given, the movement in that direction. And so what we're advocating is that we, you know, one is a large part of it is political education and making connections with other African people around the world, in Africa, in Latin America, wherever black people may be. But we're also internationalists. So we're not just, you know, obviously we're internationalists, Pan-Africanists, revolutionary Pan-Africanists are always internationalists as well. So we know that there are other oppressed people that we have to, you know, connect with, that we need to connect with to, you know, fight the global system. And that in back to our community, proposed our campaign is that we're struggling to organize the people, do political education campaigns, and that also leading up to a ballot initiative, where we put on the ballot community control of the police, and each either ward or district, which DC is made up of, will be able to vote, and whether in your ward you want, you know, to keep the police as they are or kick them out, and then the community have the opportunity to reimagine and do what they will in terms of community control over the police. And this gets rid of the need for some representative who may sell out your interest or whatever. And it also requires us and compels us to organize the people. The people must be organized to win that. And we need people to be organized on a permanent level. That's a precondition and, you know, for us to achieve what we need to do.
And it strikes me that that sort of action, it's more process than a kind of a very a single goal, I suppose. That's something that requires far more ongoing engagement and work. Yes. Than something like the episodic, you know, there's a tragedy or there's an outrage and there's a single protest or like the community organizing is, as you say, it needs to be an ongoing process.
Right, it's an ongoing process, and I mean, in some of these terms, like I'm hearing, because we hear them, they're attempted to be co-opted a lot. And so, like community organizing, even when Obama became president, he was a community organizer, right? Well, we're talking about some radical, organized, permanent mass organization for you know socialism and for like self-determination. Let's put it that way, because socialism is a state thing, but it might be an ultimate goal. But self-determination on the community level. Most impact, and yeah, you're right. So it should be combining both direct action and mobilizations with permanent organizations. So creating cooperatives and finding ways to help people with the mutual aid programs that help people survive in this under the system, and at the same time, those have to be engendered with political education of the masses, so that the people can understand what the conditions that afflict us really are about, the science of society and history and and oppression and liberation, and so we have to do educate, because the people who are, if we're talking about community control, then the people in control have to we want them to understand what it is they're fighting for, because people can make mistakes, and that the world is ever changing too. So as the world evolves and new things emerge, and we have to keep our political education going on too. So we advocate popular education, so we believe in that everyone is a teacher and a student, and that some of the most profound lessons we can learn can come from the most impacted people. Often someone will see, they don't have the formal education, but sometimes formal education is not, it's the kind of education that confuses us, and that the experiences and the lived experiences of the oppressed people are very valuable epiphanies. And so we believe in popular education, political education.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate you helping to share some of your some insights into the situation the U.S. faces and some of the challenges, not just of the individual outrage, but kind of the systemic pressures, right. that you're looking to address too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Thank you.
Thanks again to Netfa Freeman for talking to us and giving so generously of his time talking about calls for community control of policing in the US. We did want to clarify one point, one statistic given by Ms. Freeman during the interview. At one point he notes that 3 people a day are killed by police in the United States, and he asked me to clarify that is not specific to black people. That's the general statistic for people killed by police, broken down by race. It does disproportionately affect black people and Native Americans the most, and it is more than on average more than one black person every day killed by police in the US.
It's important to you to know where your food comes from. Isn't it just as important to know where your information comes from? It's not always easy to verify what you see, read, or hear. But now there's help. Visit www.bmediasmart.ie. Stop. Think. Check. Be Media Smart. Brought to you by Media Literacy Ireland, supported by your local radio station.
I'm talking to Tig, as usual. Welcome back to the show, Tig.
Thanks.
Okay. Tig, the last time we talked, it was between Passover and Easter,
yeah.
And you were on a holiday from school. You're back in school now.
Yes.
Yeah, happy with that?
Yeah.
Very good. Now, that's... You know, one of the things that's happened in the last while. The other is that we're now able to go beyond our 5 kilometers.
Yeah, we can now go in the whole county.
Yeah, and we're lucky we're in one of the larger counties, so we've got quite a distance.
Yeah, we're larger than Dublin in terms of area, but Dublin is larger than us in terms of population.
Very true. So we've got quite a bit of space we've been able to go. And we've, the last while, we've done a little bit of touring around different playgrounds, gone to some places we haven't gone before, tried out to kind of find playgrounds outside our 5 kilometer area. Any highlights from that?
Well, a few days ago we went to two playgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them I never went to before, and another one I haven't gone to in like months or years before that.
Yeah, we went to Cong, and so we went to a playground in Cong.
And the Irish for Cong is Conga. So me and Mum were saying Conga, 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 Conga.
Very good. And we went to Cong. Mm-hmm. And we saw the playground, and we also saw some other stuff. What else did we see other than the playground in Cong?
We saw
some runes, right?
I know what I'm talking about, but I just don't know how to explain it. Oh yeah, we were talking about a forest. How did I forget that the word for forest is forest?
You couldn't see the wood for the trees, Tig. We went for a walk in Cong Forest, and that's beside the old ruined abbey there. We saw the old fishing hut on the river there.
Yeah, and we also went to a place that had a bunch of stairs. I was so tired from walking up all those stairs.
Yeah, that's the...
Mm-hmm. As soon as I saw my mum and my little brother Noah, then I was like, phew, I won't have to walk anymore in my head. But then they kept walking on because they didn't see me. And I was like, uh-oh, I have to walk more.
It was an invigorating walk. It was a little bit tiring, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
And we went up. There's a tower in Cong Forest. For those who haven't been there, there's a tower called the Guinness Tower, and it's got a viewing platform of the wood and the park.
Yeah, I just hope that they don't sell Guinness there anymore, because then it would be bad for you, because they could only make it out of rocks. And they wouldn't have any electricity to power any electric things you need for making Guinness. How would I know what you need for making Guinness? I'm not part of the Guinness family.
That's a good point. You do not know what we use for it, or what they make use for making Guinness.
Yeah, since you're not part of the Guinness family either.
I am not. So we went up that up to the viewing platform. It's kind of a I don't know if it's Victorian. It's about 150 years old, 1871, I think. I don't know if it's a folly or if it's originally a viewing platform, or how you describe it, but there's a spiral staircase inside a tower, goes up to a platform at the top, and you're able to look out over the forest. We went to Clonbur, to the playground there. That's one of the better playgrounds I think we've been to recently.
Yeah.
Any other comments on the playgrounds? What you liked about them? What you didn't? Any things you'd like to see that you saw in other playgrounds that you'd like to see in playgrounds in Galway?
I'd like to see the sort of big wooden thing I saw in the second playground we went to here, because I don't know what it's called, and I forgot what the playground's called.
Are you talking about the platform? They've kind of got kind of houses and towers.
No, I meant the biggest wooden thing in there. The biggest thing in the second playground we went to.
I don't know what that was.
I'll draw it to you after the show.
Okay.
But I will probably draw it bad since I can only remember the biggest part of it.
Okay. Well, it's always good to see things you like and say, I would like if we had that in Galway. I'd like if we had that. One of the things I've noticed about playgrounds elsewhere is that a lot of them have accessible things. They've got things that if you're in a wheelchair work that we don't really have a lot of in Galway. We've got some, I think we've got some trampolines that work now, but we don't have swings for people in wheelchairs. We don't have the second playground in Clonbur. It seemed it was wheelchair accessible in the roundabout it had, which wasn't the case. Isn't the case for any in Galway. That'd be something to be nice to see.
Yeah.
Now, apart from playgrounds and travel and being able to go beyond our 5 kilometres and the outside world, you've also been online learning things on the internet recently.
Yeah.
What have you been learning about?
I've been learning about the universe just a minute before we started this, or a few. I don't know how long this was. I've been learning about antimatter.
Tell me about antimatter. What is antimatter?
Antimatter is like, I don't know how to explain it. It's like
what
anything we have, just if anything you can touch safely that isn't photons of light, touch it, then it'll explode with the things we have.
So it's kind of, it's the opposite of matter, and if matter touches it...
Yeah, it's the opposite of matter, but the same.
Okay.
Like, there are anti-electrons, protons, and neutrons, which combine to form anti-hydrogen and oxygen, which combine to form anti-water, which can be 2/3 of anti-people, which can be, which are at the top of the antimatter food chain. Why am I saying anti a lot? Oh, wait, because that's how you describe something that's made out of antimatter. You just add anti before what we call it, if it's made out of matter.
So I know you were telling me yesterday, as opposed to things like electrons that have a negative charge, an anti-electron would have a
positive charge, and there's something special about anti-electrons.
Oh, what's that?
You call them positrons.
Ah.
But you call antiprotons antiprotons.
Okay, so they don't have a special name for them. And yeah. And an antiproton, a proton has a positive charge, so an
antiproton has a negative one.
Oh, very good. Okay. Has that been fun to learn about? Has it? Some people, when they learn about those things, they feel like it melts their mind. It's so
It was crazy. Fun, but I get why you do that, because physics is weird, people.
Physics is weird.
Yeah. No offense to my favorite YouTube channel Minute Physics, if you're watching from whatever country you're in.
So the Minute Physics you like, you've been watching them. You've been watching a few other channels that help introduce you to things like quantum physics and antimatter and other things that as you say, are a little weird when it comes to physics. Ty, thank you so much for talking to me. We'll talk to you again next month.
Yeah, and by the way, there's one thing in physics that is definitely wrong in normal life. Like, you know how when babies, before babies know that they're moving, they say that they think that all of the other world is moving? Well, technically, that's true for them, and it's true for everyone else, and yeah, because of special relativity. Why did I just say mwahaha? I don't know.
Thanks, Tig. Now let's see what Noah wants to talk about with us this month.
Let's talk about my favorite kind of Pokemon, water types.
You like water type Pokemon?
Yeah.
Tell me about first off, what is a Pokemon? Not everyone who's listening to the show will know what a Pokemon is.
Tar and Ansu and Mate will know what Pokemon is.
They're your friends?
Some of them have Pokemon cards.
Oh,
I just have one, a Gyarados. It's a water type.
Okay, so
that's how I made to like water type Pokemon.
Ah, okay. So Pokemon are imaginary creatures.
What did you say?
They're imaginary. We see them in a TV show. They've got cards.
No, they're only when they're here.
Okay.
In our world, in the Pokemon, they're real.
Oh, in the Pokemon world, they're real?
Yeah.
Okay, and what are they? Are they like animals? Are they like people?
They're like both. And they also have superpowers.
Superpowers?
Yes!
Okay, what type of superpowers do they have?
They have my favorite kinds, water types. They have water powers. My best one of all the water Pokemon, it is... Guess what it is, Dad?
I don't know. Is it a Pikachu?
No. I said water types.
I know nothing about Pokemon. This is why I'm asking you questions, because I need to learn.
Oh. I can tell you
okay.
What my favorite Pokemon is. I will whisper it to you, and then you guess it. It's a Popplio. Say it.
Popplio?
Popplio!
Popplio? What's a Popplio?
It's a sea lion Pokemon. It has a long nose, and it has a pink ball at the end of it now to do bubble beam.
Now, this is the interesting thing about Pokemon, is that they all seem to be like an animal in our world with some superpowers and some things that make them look a little different. So the Popichu, go on, you can say it, I can't say
Pikachu.
It. Well, Pikachu is like a mouse. Pop
Leo.
Popplio is like a sea lion.
With a long nose and a ball at the end. It has flippered four hands and it can do surf and aqua jet.
Aqua jet? Aqua jet.
Yeah.
Okay. Very cool. Now, and so I've noticed that the Pokemon, they have the powers, but then they also have trainers. What do the trainers do? And the trainers are people.
Yes. The trainers keep the Pokemon and train them.
And help them get better at their powers?
Yeah.
And what makes Pokemon fun?
They save. They are great, great, great. And they stop Team Rocket if they're on Ash's side. But not Team Rocket.
Okay. So they're very good at helping their...
And Team Rocket have a Pokemon, Robert Fair.
So team. So the so.
And also a meowse.
A meowse.
Not a meowse. Meowse.
Is that like a cat or like a mouse?
A cat. A scratch type Pokemon.
So you talk about Pokemon with your friends. You play Pokemon games. You.
Pokemon games with Sebastian. I like to pretend he's Pikachu.
And what does he pretend you are?
I was a Psyduck, and then I evolved into Golduck. Psyduck and Golduck are water types.
Wow.
Let's talk about Popplio.
Okay, let's talk about Popplio. Tell me about Popplio.
Okay. He have Bubble Beam with it nose. And Aqua Jet with also his nose. And Surf.
Also with his nose?
No. I forgot how he does it, but it's a wave to Surf on. And when Popplio beginning doing Surf, it was with Sandy. I forgot what kind of Pokemon it is. And I forgot what type. I remember what it looked like. It almost looked like a Vulpix.
Okay.
Like Snowy. Snowy is an ice type.
So you've been telling me about a lot of different Pokemon, a lot of different Pokemon types. And that makes me think it must be very complicated to learn them all and to remember them all.
I watch Pokemon when I started watching Pokemon. And now when I end starting watching Pokemon, I need to tell you something.
Yeah.
You didn't hear what I said.
Okay, one more thing for our listeners.
Sea crystals get into Z-Wings, and then they go to and the Z-Wing Z-Crystal have the power for the same type of Pokemon that is the Z-Crystal.
Well, Noah, thank you so much for telling our listeners a little bit about Pokemon, which is your new, would it be fair to say your obsession? You've been thinking about Pokemon a lot recently?
Yeah. This had been a Critical Ear. This has been a Critical Ear.
A Critical Ear is broadcast on Flirt FM in Galway and available online at acriticalear.info. Presented and produced by Andrew Boyle. Guest appearances by Tig and Noah. Thank you.